SBS தமிழ்.
கிரீட்டிங்ஸ் அருண்குமார் அபே, அண்ட் கங்க்ராச்சுலேஷன்ஸ் ஆன் வினிங் தி ஆர்டர் ஆஃப் ஆஸ்திரேலியா அவார்ட்.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for coming to the studio. And because you have a unique or slightly unique background, can you tell us about your upbringing and background?
Yes, well, I was born in Colombo, and my mother was a Tamil. She was actually born in Benares. Her mother had come from Madras, and she's actually quite an extraordinary background. My grandmother was probably one of the first women in the world to go to university in the UK. She went to the London School of Economics. Her elder sisters studied medicine. In fact, her elder sister became the gynecologist to Indira Gandhi. So, yeah, I guess strong background in education and so on, which is very, I suppose, typical of the Tamil side. My father was Sinhalese. He was a journalist in Colombo, and my parents met on the Times of Ceylon. And I was born in May 1958, in the middle of the first riots. And my parents' biggest challenge, I suppose, was trying to work out how to get me safely from the hospital back home.
How was your childhood growing up with a mixed parenthood?
Well, you know, in Colombo at that time, I suppose the English-educated Sinhalese and Tamils and Burghers and everyone else, really, there used to be one community. And unfortunately, in Sri Lanka, because of the politics of division, which we've seen, starting back at that time, and I think brought to life in a wonderful way by the recent play by Shakti, Counting and Cracking, which was on at the Sydney Town Hall, part of the Sydney Festival recently, that politics of division have really caused a terrible situation in Sri Lanka, which continues today with the latest bombings and so on. But I suppose it was not something I was really aware of. By and large, we spent time with my mother's people in Bambalapitiya, and I was exposed to the Tamil background. My father's people were from Narvalapitiya, in the highlands. So we spent some time with them as well. But there was never, between my parents, there was never really any sense of tension. There was a very, very strong, I think, bond in terms of they thought of themselves as Sri Lankans or Ceylonese at that time. And it's a shame, I suppose, that more people in our community don't actually think like that.
I didn't mean tension between your parents, but people around you, how they perceived the mixed parenthood.
I suppose, look, we came out to Australia when I was relatively young, not as migrants, but in 62, 63. And
during the White Australia policy.
Yes, but we weren't migrants. We actually came, my father got a job to promote Ceylon tea. So we came on a three-year contract. And, you know, in a sense, you get used to be, because, you know, at that time, we were the only South Asians, for the reasons you just mentioned, in Sydney. And my mother would wear a sari. I remember we'd go to Wynyard Station and so on, and the entire place would come to a standstill. Not with any hostility, but people would just look with curiosity at these different people wearing this very different costume.
How young were you?
I was about five, and so we were here for 3 years. Then I went back to Sri Lanka in the mid-60s. For 2 years, we had home leave. Then my father got another contract. So we went backwards and forwards. So I had an unusual upbringing. By the time I was 16, I'd spent half my life in Sri Lanka, half my life in Australia. So in every place, I was the different person. And the fact that I had a Tamil mother and Sinhalese father probably wasn't the biggest deal. In Sri Lanka, I went to St. Thomas's for a while. And I think the biggest issue was that I was probably the only person who had ever gone overseas.
Oh, yes.
At that stage. And so in Sri Lanka, they called me the Australian. In Australia, they called me the Sri Lankans.
Interesting. Congratulations on winning the Australian Order of Merit Award. How do you feel about that?
Look, it's a very great, great honour. And the reality is that, you know, to achieve these sorts of honours, there's a whole range of people who are involved in your success. And to the extent I've had success, certainly the role of my parents has been fundamental. I think they gave me a sense of the power of possibility to actually try and do daring and worthwhile things. They also promoted very strongly the idea of making a difference, which are elements of this reward. But, you know, the reality is, in building anything, the business which we built in, financial advice and wealth management, involved a very large number of people, all of whom, you know, contributed to what we've achieved. And if we hadn't really had the business success, which we had in financial advice and wealth management, through my previous company, IPAC, and now through my current business, Walsh Bear Partners, if we hadn't had that success driven by many people, I wouldn't have had the money really to do the philanthropic work which I've done. So, you know, I'd salute all the people who've been involved in that journey with me.
What got you interested in financial management?
So I began life in a learning sense at the ANU, which is a wonderful university. I did a degree in arts, studying Indonesian as well as Asian studies, and also an economics degree. And my interest initially was to work in developing countries. And I did that. I focused in particular on Indonesia with some work in India and Sri Lanka as well. And I think this whole area of, you know, poverty alleviation and so on is, you know, has been an enduring passion and interest of mine. But in the early 80s, you know, 83 in particular, Bob Hawke and Paul Keating came to power as the Prime Minister and Treasurer. And they revolutionized the Australian economy, as has been written up recently in the, after the death of Bob Hawke. And what I saw working in research, I had a research job at the ANU, was that this was going to open up a very different world, that for the first time, Australians would need to go from being savers to being investors. And there was the opportunity to actually do that. What I saw was that the financial advice industry at that time really wasn't geared towards that. So we saw an opportunity. And with three or four other people, we were in our mid-20s, we had really no idea about business. And we had a lot to learn. But we saw this opportunity and decided to seize it. Launched a startup company. And after about 20 years, we were an overnight success.
Most of the people from our island take the easier path by working for someone. What gave you the courage to start something on your own, be an entrepreneur?
Look, it's hard to say, because as you said, coming out of Sri Lanka, the great focus is on security. And in fact, it's extraordinary how many things that Sri Lankans will actually sacrifice. And you know, Sri Lankans have fantastic ability, fantastic education, have been successful wherever they've gone. I mean, one of the ironies of Sri Lanka, I suppose, is that within the country, we're not that successful. Outside of the country, we're very successful. And it just shows what we could have done with the right leadership. But I suppose I'd encourage people, especially younger people, to give it a go. There's always the risk of failure, but the greatest risk is to not try, because that guarantees, you know, in a sense, that guarantees failure, or guarantees that you won't achieve your maximum potential. But I think one of the elements, the sort of elements of an entrepreneur, is some sort of vision for something which is different. There's by and large not a huge amount of point of being an entrepreneur and just doing the same sort of thing. What's your point of difference? That's one element. The second is actually the desire to be fairly independent. You know, by and large, I don't like reporting to other people. I'm very happy to work in a cooperative and collaborative way. You know, I don't particularly like giving orders and that sort of stuff. But for me, actually working at the bottom of a hierarchy was never something which I particularly aspired to. So I suppose those are important elements.
You have written two books. Both go with the title, How Much is Enough? And then a subtitle, How Much is Enough?
So what I found when we started off life in business and in Australia, because my parents were paid essentially a Sri Lankan wage, but working in Australia. So, you know, we didn't, money was always a struggle. And my assumption was that people with money would be automatically well off and happy. And over, I suppose I started my career 35 years ago, and we ended up building a global business. So I've worked in many countries, and it surprised me that the wealthier people were, the more complex their lives seemed to be. And often, not always, but often their children seemed to be undermined by money. And, I'd observed this, but didn't really understand it. But in the last 10 or 20 years, I've retained strong links with research. I chair the College of Business and Economics at the ANU, the advisory board. And so in the last 20 years, there's been a lot of research looking at the relationship between money and well-being. It's a lot of behavioral research. And the way I try and understand things is to research it and then write about it, I guess my research background. And so How Much is Enough draws together a whole range of areas from behavioral research. And the essence of the thesis, I suppose, is this: that you can be, you know, you can be happy and you can be rich, but in a sense, what's important is first of all to work out what makes you happy first. The people who work out what's important to them, the people who are motivated, who find work which is meaningful, which is purposeful, which engages them, not in the pursuit of money in the first instance, funny enough, end up having a much better attitude towards money. They end up using money much more wisely, both for their own generation and subsequent generations. Whereas the people who say, look, let me pursue the money first, and then I'll worry about the happiness, it actually never works. Because you don't really find your true passion. You don't really focus on how you can make a difference to others. And you know that path is really the path of more enduring well-being.
In the public domain, you identified a patron or contributor to at least 16 different charities or organizations, ranging from healthcare to arts. What made you think that not only your wealth is important, but also to distribute that to various causes?
Well, so I think going back to my grandparents, my Tamil grandparents, and also my Sinhalese grandparents, I guess, but also my parents, you know, their primary focus was making a difference. In fact, they weren't very good at making money at all. But that was an ethos which is built into us. In terms of the various things we support, I suppose it reflects a range of interests. One is education and learning. Going back to my grandmother and my parents, there's just this love of learning and reading and so on. And so that's an important area we've focused on. Including a great charity in Australia called the Smith Family, which, you know, focuses on the education of disadvantaged children. I've had the privilege of being on the board of the Smith Family for the last 12 years. My parents love culture. They love the arts. And I was brought up in a household where dance was very important. So my father actually went to one of the first performances of the Chitrasena Dance Company in Colombo back in the 50s when he was a journalist. Working in the Times, and my mother loved dancing, so he introduced her to them. So we had this Tamil lady who'd learned a whole heap of Tamil dancing, Bharatanatyam and Kathakali and so on. But she also fell in love with Kandyan dancing, and we actually helped to bring the Chitrasena Dance Company out to Australia in 1963, the first Asian dance company ever to come to Australia. They came out again in 72 and then more recently for the Sydney Festival in 2014. So the performing arts has been important, and we've supported the performing arts in Sri Lanka as well as the Australian Ballet here. I mentioned poverty alleviation, and there's been great advances, and that was an area I worked on for a few years with the Australian National University. So I think supporting in particular communities to actually help themselves through microfinance, that is making small loans to small entrepreneurs, you know, people. When you talk about Sri Lankans not being entrepreneurial, actually, there's a lot. But the entrepreneurs in Sri Lanka are by and large on the street, okay. And for them, a small amount of money—it's extraordinary—a loan of $100, simply to buy local equipment to be able to run a small kade on the roadside makes a huge difference. So those have been some of the important areas. And medical research, I guess, going back to my grandfather, great doctor. Was responsible for, in a sense, the revival of Ayurvedic medicine in Sri Lanka. Was the deputy president of the Ayurvedic College in Colombo, and we learned a lot, and was inspired by that. My elder son is now involved in medical research as a neuroscientist as well, so it's been an important area for us as well.
Thank you very much, Arun Kumar, for coming to the studios and giving us the time to do this interview, and congratulations again on this award that Australia had bestowed on you.
Thank you so much for your interest.
இதை போன்ற இன்னும் பல நிகழ்ச்சிகளை செவிமடுக்க sbs.com.au/tamil